2020, debriefing the last 3 years. A day of special programming looking back at the Trump regime, what happened, why, and the repercussions domestically and internationally. We'll focus on national policy, foreign policy, privacy and surveillance, policing, immigration, labor rights, confronting white nationalism, the environment, and much more. Again, that's Hindsight 2020, debriefing the last 3 years on Tuesday, January 21st from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. here on your community radio, KBOO Portland.
And like the man said, this is KBOO Portland. It's 10 o'clock. It's time for Cool Solutions. Let's check it out.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis. And you're listening to Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up.
We know the climate news has been pretty depressing lately, but here's a bright spot.
A recent analysis by America's Pledge Coalition finds that bottom-up actions and commitments by U.S. cities, states, and businesses will reduce greenhouse gas emissions 25% by 2030. That's no small potatoes.
It's actually half of the whole enchilada, halfway to where we need to be by 2030 to keep global warming under 1.5°C. And speaking of cutting out warming from the bottom up, we've got two great stories for you about people taking that quite literally. Their weapons of choice, crowbars and thermometers.
First up, the crowbar.
One, two, three.
That is the sound of a group of people ripping up asphalt. They're volunteers with Depave Portland, an Oregon group that brings community members together to remove pavement and replace it with gardens and play areas.
It all started back in 2008 when Arif Khan and Cassandra Griffin wanted to plant trees in their backyard, but it was covered with pavement. They invited some friends, smashed it to bits, and it was so much fun, they decided to take out a whole parking lot.
Katya Reyna, DPA's project coordinator, explains what happened next.
They did one project and they were like, all right, that was fun. And the way the story's been told to me is that simultaneously there was an event happening at a park across the street. And so when they finished the depaving project, walked over to this event, and somebody got on stage and was like, look across the street, they're depaving and they're gonna keep doing it all over. And they were like, what? That's not the plan.
And that's how Depave Portland began. Since then, the group has mobilized over 3,000 volunteers and has removed 150,000 square feet of pavement.
Depave focuses its efforts on the far eastern side of Portland. It's the low-rent part of town, where immigrants go to find cheap housing and where poor and working people end up when gentrification pushes them out of their neighborhoods.
There's way more pavement out there. There's more of a need for green spaces. And there's also just communities that haven't really been included in conversations about development, where investment goes.
So how do you go about finding pavement to pull up?
More often than not, hosts find us. We've done quite a few sites in eastern Portland, so those communities already know who we are and what we do.
Once a group asks for Depave's help, Katya pays them a visit.
They would explain to me what the issues are. Our basement is flooding all the time, or these kids don't have anywhere to play except for this giant swath of asphalt. It's very much us having a conversation with the site host and saying, you know your site, what do you need here? This is for you.
There are costs to removing asphalt.
The costs include disposing of that asphalt, and then you have to refill it with something, so soil, wood chips, or permeable pavers. We help them come up with a budget, and then with that, we say, okay, now how much money do you have? Do you have a friend that works at the hauling company or a friend that can donate plants? And they tell us what they can provide. And then the rest we roll into our grants.
To get a project off the ground, two seasonal cycles have to come together.
When the grant cycles are and when we have to spend that money, but also by the rains. We have a very heavy rain season in Portland, so we don't really like to do depave projects between November and March because that's when it's really pouring rain and nobody wants to come out and rip out asphalt.
Although projects range from a few square feet to several thousand square feet, it's all done by hand. I mean, you could just spring in a big machine.
Why use manual labor?
We're trying to help sites that typically don't have a big budget. So there is the financial reason. But more than anything, we want people to feel invested, to have a part in this project that's helping their community. People often feel very disempowered, feel like the city just does things to them, that developers just come in and build things and they don't get any say, they have no power. And so I think saying, we're going to rip this up together, you're building this rain garden, you're filtering this water, you built this playground. When you get people to come out and actually be a part of it and really understand what they're doing, you really are building something much more than a green space. You're building a lifetime of understanding the benefits of these spaces, but also a lifetime of feeling empowered and feeling like you built something and you're a part of something bigger than yourself.
DPAVE usually works at schools, churches, and community centers, but they recently did a project at a commercial property called Plaza 122.
Plaza 122 is a 1960s-style strip mall shopping plaza on a busy four-lane thoroughfare in East Portland. It houses a mix of local businesses and nonprofits.
What makes it different from any other strip mall is that it's jointly owned by over 100 community members who are shareholders in a community development investment trust organized by Mercy Corps, an international aid and microfinance organization headquartered here in Portland.
All you have to do to buy into Plaza 122 is live within one of the city zip codes surrounding the property, take a financial class, and invest at least $10 a month.
Mustafa Finney is one of Plaza 122's investors.
I've been watching this project since it was started and kind of skeptical at first, and then went through a stage of kind of sitting back and listening, and now I'm all in. Just being part of that development, I think, gives people a sense of community that they need. I think a lot of communities, especially communities of color, you know, being a young Black man in Portland, my community has been displaced. And just seeing people have ownership over somewhere and try to hold down an anchor and make something their own, and me being able to walk past it and talk to people, friends and family about, hey, I own a piece of this. Y'all want in? It's just amazing. I think it's life-changing.
Mustafa uses the word desolate to describe the local landscape.
There's been a lot of food deserts and concrete jungles and a lot of packed-in housing complexes. It has been a forgotten part of Portland.
But now the area is getting attention from the city and from developers. Property values are rising fast, an early sign of gentrification. The Plaza 122 project aims to help residents establish an economic foothold so they can share in the benefits of local development instead of becoming its victims.
Sven Gachev is Plaza 122's operation manager. When rainwater started leaking into the plaza basement, he called DPAVE for help. Gachev made a site visit.
Their parking lot was completely oversized. It was just a giant swath of asphalt. There were a few things we could do to help them out. First was to build about 1,000-square-foot rain garden in the middle of the parking lot, and two smaller rain gardens on the side, about 150 square feet each. And then when we started walking to the back of the lot, we saw these big, giant, beautiful Doug fir trees. Douglas firs are our state tree in Oregon. These are some very beautiful, giant old ones. And we looked down at the roots and they were completely covered in asphalt. Somebody had paved over all the tree roots. We were like, we can relieve these tree roots and put some native understory.
At first, the plaza's tenants were not happy with the idea. Here's Sven.
People were pretty fixated on their parking lots and their parking spots. And businesses justifiably want to make sure that their customers can access their businesses easily. So they were skeptical and they were nervous.
But the project moved forward.
About 2 weeks before, I'll go out there with a couple volunteers. And with the site host, we mark out where we're going to cut. Just to make sure that we're all on the same page, we paint out the lines. And then we rent some walk-behind saws. They're pretty big and they're really loud. And cut the area that we're going to rip out into 2 feet by 2 feet pieces so that when the volunteers come out, they can just use the pry bars and pull them up.
How thick is this layer of pavement you have to saw through?
It's anywhere between 3 and 6 inches of asphalt. And then below that, there's about 3 inches of gravel. And then below that, there's soil.
Do you ever find anything surprising underneath? Skeletons, gold doubloons?
More often than not, it's another layer of asphalt. That's usually the surprise. And a couple times when we start digging down, we have found a third layer. And so it ends up being about 9 inches of asphalt.
DPAVE has done this so many times that they know how to make a depaving day run like clockwork.
I arrive on site with a U-Haul truck full of pry bars, wheelbarrows, shovels, all the equipment we need. We always have a sign up booth where people sign a waiver. We've actually developed an amazing crew leader collective. So we have our crew leaders who have been doing depavings for years, and they actually lead all the volunteers on depave day. So the crew leaders step up, they're all wearing orange vests, and they go through a safety talk. They teach all the volunteers how to use the pry bars, make sure everybody has closed-toed shoes, and do a quick demo on how to rip up the asphalt.
The crew leader gives a little pep talk.
This was going to be fun, this was going to be work, and this was going to be as shortest amount of time as possible. So you can break a sweat, but don't feel like you've been lifting rocks all day long.
Then let the fun begin.
Here's what they do. A team of several people levers up one of those big asphalt squares so it's only resting on one edge. Then they drop it so it smashes into pieces, load it into wheelbarrows, and take it to the dumpsters.
Everyone working together, it's just amazing how we filled 5 huge dumpsters of asphalt completely full to the top with just 25, 30 people. Actually, our property manager, who just had taken on this new job, I told him that this is what we're going to be doing. So he's like, okay, great, I'm going to go check it out. He couldn't believe that these were all volunteers and this is what they were doing. And he was all in leisure clothes and ready to have his weekend. He's like, no, I need to get my hands dirty. I want to be part of this. So he actually got out there and started removing pieces of asphalt as well. So it was really just amazing to see energy breed more positive energy.
There's something attractive about this activity that just draws people in.
DPAVE has its own volunteer base of folks that just really like to do it. People have described it to us as, oh, you just get addicted to it. Like, you just get a high from ripping out this asphalt, and it's so satisfying. People tell us, my day-to-day job, I don't get to see a finished product. And I think that that really fulfills that.
Depaving even comes with a playlist.
There's music blasting the whole time.
As a DJ, I need to know what they play.
R&B, just upbeat Motown. It was so much fun.
It was supposed to take 4 hours. They finished in 2.
All told, they removed 1,600 feet of pavement, prepared the ground for 2 additional small rain gardens on either side of the buildings, and even uncovered those dug fir roots.
Later, DPAVE had another workday for planting. Mustafa was there.
Me and my foster son came out and just dug in the dirt and planted plants. 4 trees that are going to get pretty big, and then spaced out in between those trees are plants that are going to be able to catch water and filter pollution.
The tenants fell in love with the rain gardens before it even started raining.
Already we're hearing back from them. They're saying they love it. They love the greenery. In October, it wasn't raining when we first planted the plants and trees. And their tenants are saying, can we go out there and maybe water it? How can I help in order to make sure that this thrives?
What Katja said about empowerment and local stewardship, that's real.
Being a part of that project was like being a part of history. Driving past 122nd. And seeing it for times to come, just being able to say, like, I was a part of that.
I asked Katja if she ever goes back to Plaza 122.
Oh my gosh, I go to Plaza 122 all the time. Whenever I'm having a bad day or I kind of am losing it, whether it's through a permitting process or having trouble figuring out how we're gonna fund something, you know, we'll hit a bump in the road, and I will often go to Plaza 122 because I design part of it and cut the asphalt, and it really grounds me and makes me feel like I did something. And yeah, it's really a beautiful thing to go back to a site that has been transformed and soak in the accomplishment of not just myself and DPAVE, but that the community really came together, and this is the result of that. It's a nice reminder of why we do what we're doing.
To Cool Solutions, stories of climate action from the bottom up. We've been talking with Katja Reyna, Sven Gotchev, and Mustafa Finney about depaving in Portland.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. One-third to one-half of the average U.S. city is covered with pavement. We're not going to rip it all out with our bare hands.
You're right. We really have to focus on parking lot prevention. Besides, as gratifying as it is to rip up asphalt, it only gets recycled into pavement somewhere else. Some people divide climate action into adaptation, preparing for a warming world, and mitigation, preventing warming. Tackling our oversupply of parking lots does both. Too much parking encourages driving, our country's biggest source of greenhouse gas emissions. It also causes storm runoff and sewage overflows in heavy rains. We delve deep into these issues. That sounds gross. Explored in depth? We looked into it really well in a previous fascinating episode on parking that you can find on our podcast.
But the problem with pavement isn't just driving or storm runoff. It's the vicious cycle of asphalt and heat. Because cities have a lot of pavement, they become what's called urban heat islands, places where summer temperatures can be as much as 20 degrees hotter than surrounding rural areas.
And here again, it's a crossover issue. 87% of U.S. homes have air conditioners. They use a lot of energy. If it's dirty, that adds to global warming. And air conditioners are multiplying around the world. The International Energy Agency projects that by 2050, the world's air conditioners will use as much electricity as the combined output of the U.S., EU, and Japan. So preventing pavement is part of protecting the planet. It's also important for protecting people. Heat makes people sick, and it kills more people than any other kind of extreme weather, not just in places like Phoenix and Las Vegas. People in cooler cities like Portland are affected at much lower temperatures. Brendan Haggerty is an epidemiologist who coordinates the climate and health program at the Multnomah County Health Department, which covers the city of Portland.
We get real-time data from emergency departments through a statewide system that is intended to enable us to tell when we're seeing a sudden or sustained increase in various kinds of diseases. We start to see upticks in emergency department visits and in all-cause mortality in the low to mid-90s. For some parts of the country, those are temperatures they experience for a large part of the year, but those are relatively unusual here. We Portlanders are not well acclimated to heat.
Portland summers are breaking heat records. The National Weather Service issues a heat advisory when a combination of temperature and humidity creates heat that feels like 105 degrees. This never used to happen in Portland, but now it does. During heat waves, Portland opens air-conditioned cooling centers, but that doesn't stop the ER visits and deaths. Vivek Shandis of the Sustainable Urban Places Research Lab at Portland State University wanted to know why. He started out with two theories. Theory A, not the right information. Maybe the thermal satellite imaging researchers were using to look at urban heat wasn't telling the whole story.
You're looking top down, so you're looking at rooftops and you're looking at trees from the top down and you're looking at often temperatures that are much higher, especially in cities, than what people actually experience as they're walking on sidewalks 2 meters or 6 feet above the ground. What satellite imagery also misses is that it's a very coarse level. It's usually about 90 meters pixels. These aren't tiny little street level perspective. It's actually been remarkably inaccurate for us to be able to gauge what a person would be feeling, the actual thermal comfort they'd be having as they're walking about when you're looking at satellite imagery.
Theory B, not the right people. Maybe the information wasn't getting from the engineers measuring the heat to the people who could actually do something about it.
They were really interested in sensor technologies and the link to these massive 300 by 300 meter grid cells linked to meteorological models and all of this complicated stuff. And there was something that was sitting very uncomfortable with me because a lot of this work had just been going on in the very technical dimensions. And what I was seeing is that communities weren't really making any changes at the very local level. And so that really was at the deep, unsettling place for me. And where I wanted to go with this is let's take all of this amazing stuff the engineers and meteorologists and scientists have come up with, and let's liberate it with the communities that really have an interest in wanting to take some local climate action. There must be a better way. We certainly have the sensor technology. We certainly have the community interest. How do we actually bring that together in a way where communities can kind of own the data, can own the way that they go about interpreting it, can own the solutions that emerge as a result of the understandings that communities make about their neighborhoods? You know, we've been measuring our own temperature since we were children. And so it's a very accessible notion. So why not go out and see how buildings and roads and trees and all the things around us every day mediate some of those temperatures? And let's put some sensors on cars. Let's put some sensors on bicycles. Let's get communities going out there and collecting hundreds of thousands of individual temperature and humidity measurements. That's really how much of this work was born, was just really through an unsettling feeling that these technical assessments are just not going to cut it, and we really need to engage communities in this work, and that's how we'll see local actions actually take root.
So around the same time that Arif and Cassandra were levering up their first piece of asphalt, Vivek launched a project to help people take the temperature of their own neighborhoods using a gadget that he developed with engineers. It's made of PVC pipe, and it looks a little like a periscope. Inside is a temperature sensor linked to a GPS. It hooks onto a car window.
As people drive around their neighborhoods, the sensors are recording location-linked temperatures every second. A computer turns this data into a heat map with resolution down to the block and even the building level.
The mobile heat sensors took their maiden voyage in the summer of 2015 when a group of volunteers hit the streets in Portland during a heat wave with triple-digit temperatures.
The resulting heat map revealed that the city doesn't bake evenly. There was a 15-degree temperature difference between the hottest and coolest parts of the city.
And East Portland stuck out like a big red-hot thumb. That led Vivek to another question.
Who's really taking the brunt of these heat waves? Who's suffering from that?
To answer that, he took a closer look at the hotspots.
Those who live in extreme poverty, very high racial diversity in their neighborhoods, who don't have air conditioning and live farther from cooling centers, are all living in some of the hottest parts of Portland. The municipal planners really wanted to know, what do we do about this? So the map was helpful for them to be able to say, we need to be much more focusing our efforts in East Portland.
Bill Cunningham is an urban planner with Portland's Department of Housing and Sustainability.
We are a growing city. We're expecting 100,000 people in the next 20 years.
Much of the buildable land left in the city is in East Portland, and it's slated for multifamily development.
We wanted to know, what is the relationship between the kind of development you're encouraging and the kind of temperatures you end up with?
We ended up answering that question through a series of scenarios. We were able to use the SimCity kind of technique, where you're able to look at a city block, redesign the developments, saying, what if we were to move the buildings around, increase densities, put different kinds of designs at that city block level, what would be the impacts on local temperature? And so we ran a series of scenarios there. We were actually able to find two scenarios where we can maintain, or even in one case, reduce the pre-density temperatures and yet also increase the density from 16 units on that city block to 64 units on that city block. So that would allow us to increase density while maintaining temperatures. And that was an aha moment.
You know, it's funny that all this sophisticated gadgetry and computation takes us back to things people have known for a very long time.
Surprisingly, we actually found that this historic kind of European design, where you have a city block and you have the buildings on the edge of that city block with an open space in the middle. So you might think back to the 1800s, 1700s, or pre-cars, where the carriages or what have you would go through a little portal, this middle open courtyard space, and then all the buildings would be around that courtyard. That one came out as one of the most noticeable in terms of its ability to increase density while reducing temperatures.
Get that? Reducing temperatures. They found that this green courtyard-style complex was 8 degrees cooler than traditional apartments surrounded by blacktop, and, surprisingly, 3 degrees cooler than a block of single-family homes.
Modern European cities still use this configuration.
In Copenhagen, you have these blocks of high-density housing, like 6 stories, but look out the back and there's a green area with trees.
And remember those big Doug firs behind Plaza 122? They're not alone.
East Portland has soaring groves of Douglas firs. Douglas firs are pretty iconic for the Northwest. Very often they're in the middles of our blocks.
The planning department applied the information obtained from Vivek's on-the-ground sensors and the resulting computer models to develop new multifamily housing standards for East Portland, including courtyards and deep setbacks in the rear of properties to keep the centers of city blocks green.
So when apartment dwellers look out their back windows and see fir trees, they can pretend they're in Copenhagen.
Well, it's maybe not transatlantic, but that change in building standards is a big leap. Where the old regime required so much parking that half the property would be covered with asphalt, the new rules limit pavement and require green space instead.
Bringing lots of new residents with limited parking into a neighborhood provokes concern among people who are already there.
Getting down at ground level was critical to inform the community in terms of what are the implications of their choices. We did not want to start out by just telling people, this is the right way of doing things, so do it or you're a NIMBY. We wanted to have a conversation with the community where we engage them in discussing trade-offs. You want tons of parking, you can do that, but these are the impacts in urban heat. If there's not so much parking, there's also more space for green.
Fortunately, they didn't have to go back to the Middle Ages or to Copenhagen to find examples of cool courtyards.
Prior to the 1950s, we had pretty rich tradition of courtyard apartments where the apartments are oriented around a green courtyard. And people really value that kind of housing. And when we highlighted the fact that when we started requiring parking, the courtyards got replaced by parking lots, it became very tangible when you highlighted real examples they are familiar with about some of the trade-offs. So when we highlight the fact that our regulations are intended to encourage things like courtyard apartments, people get it. It doesn't seem quite so pie in the sky. Planners talking about some theoretical housing type that no one's ever going to build.
In the end, the plan won public support and was passed by the City Council in December of 2019.
So that's how getting urban heat measurement out of the lab and into the streets in the hands of local people brought cool buildings where they're needed the most, along with more housing, less driving, lower energy use, and healthier people.
That's climate action from the bottom up.
So far, citizen scientists have used the tool developed by Dr. Shondas to map heat in 11 U.S. cities, and the project is spreading. If you want to make a street-level heat map or see a satellite heat map of your city, look in the action toolbox for this episode at cool-solutions.org.
But for right now, it's winter, the start of Portland's very, very rainy season, and the plants in Plaza 122's new rain garden are getting their first good drink.
It's been raining in Portland, but not historic Portland rain.
So far, it's been looking great. The rain garden's filling up, and it's getting absorbed over the hours following huge rains, and we've had zero flooding so far.
Maybe we'll come back on the show and see how that rain garden is doing for us. We are live from the basement, dry so far.
I'm Wendy Ring.
And I'm Brian Curtis, and you've been listening to Cool Solutions, climate action from the bottom up. If you're ready to do something about climate change where you live, check out our podcast for more cool actions you can take in your community.
Thanks to our guests, Katya Reyna, Sven Gotchev, Mustafa Finney,
Brendan Haggerty, Vivek Shondas, and Bill Cunningham.
And thanks to Quincas Morera, Unicorn Heads, Dan Leibowitz, Musics Recreation, and Lobo Loco for our music.
KBOO is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Folk Music Society 2019-20 concert season. Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor kick off 2020 on Friday, January 17th. They are co-lead singers and primary songwriters for the Grammy Award-winning O'Connor Band. That's Kate Lee and Forrest O'Connor, Friday, January 17th at 7:30 p.m., doors at 7, at the Reedwood Friends Church, 2901 Southeast Steele Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
And it's 10:30 a.m. Well, it's 10:29 a.m. on KBOO Portland. This is your community radio. That means keeping it vibrant, fierce, independent, and healthy is your responsibility. You can fulfill, you can discharge that obligation at kboo.fm/give. So why don't you do that right now while I remind you of one of your friends and neighbors that got involved in the way that made sense to them. I get to remind you that KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Dark Side Cinema, open every night and featuring independent, foreign, and art house films. The Dark Side is located at 215 Southwest 4th Street between Madison and Jefferson Avenues in Corvallis, Oregon. More information and showtimes available online at darksidecinema.com.
Okay, this is Film at 11, as usual at 10:30 on Friday morning. This is DK Holm, and I'm here with Rick Mitchell, our in-house music expert for this show.
Good morning.
And if not, all of America. And then Ben...
Pop,
P-O-P-P. Okay. Yeah. And Ben is from the Northwest Film Center, and we're going to be discussing the Real Music Festival, which opens a week from today. Yep. So we've got a little bit of advance on that. And among the many things that we'll be talking about is Robbie Robertson.